Welcome to Doc Talks Fishing, where science and fishing make a big splash. Join Gord and Liam with this week's guest.
Have you guys ever wondered what muskies actually eat? We know they eat ciscos, yellow perch, bullheads, and a whole bunch of other fish, but they get a kind of a bad reputation in some bodies of water with some anglers because they think they're eating their walleyes. But as we're going to talk about today, fascinatingly, that couldn't be further from the truth. But they are very, very particular at the same time about what they eat.
You know what really interests me, and I want to hear Camden talk about this, Liam, is I've read some of his research, and he talks about memorable size muskies. And I think those are 45 inches and bigger. Those are the memorable fish. And my understanding from his research is they eat something different, totally different from smaller fish. And the other thing that I've got a sense from reading his work is muskies in lakes with ciscos and muskies in lakes without ciscos, their diets are often completely different. So it's going to be fascinating hearing what he has discovered. And as you know, he uses a technique called gastric lavage to wash out their stomachs, if you will. And it's amazing. And then he uses DNA. So even though it's just a little piece of a backbone that flushes out of a muskie stomach, they can identify exactly what it is.
Crazy. Well, it is. Well, I mean, Camden Glade is one of those guys, too, that's spent a ton of time doing this with the electrofishing, several other methods, capturing a lot of muskies safely, releasing them after, doing the studies to really get a good, solid understanding of the species in particular bodies of water. Let's welcome in Camden. So, Camden, welcome to the podcast, and we're really looking forward to today's chat.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Honest truth, and this is the honest truth. A year or two ago, I read the report that you put together. I think it was for the North American Journal of Fisheries Management, and it absolutely blew my mind. I mean, Liam and I are avid muskie anglers, and when I started reading that, so many things fell into place, but I have to be honest, so it raised so many more questions. And so that's why we're so glad you're on the show today, to fill all the folks in on the amazing work that you did. And then we'll gradually go towards what it really means, I guess, when we're out fishing. So, as I say, you know, you did this amazing study, and you looked at the diet and of muskies and how it might have overlapped with walleyes and northern and largemouth bass. What were the specific questions and concerns that were driving you?
Yeah, so I guess just backing up a little bit, back in like 2016, there was kind of a push in the Minnesota legislature to kind of change how Minnesota manages its muskie populations. There were some different factors at play there, but basically the underlying question behind it all was, how do these big predators with mouths full of huge teeth affect other fish that just kind of objectively more people in the state are interested in catching in terms of walleye, pike, and bass, as opposed to kind of the fairly limited number of muskie anglers in the state. And ultimately that effort in the legislature didn't amount to anything. There were no changes, but it did kind of indicate to the state biologists that, you know, there may be some knowledge gaps here in terms of muskie biology and what they're doing in these lakes, especially because about half the lakes in the state are managed by stocking. So they're kind of artificial populations in these lakes. So it's just important to know what effect those management efforts are having on these other native fish populations. So kind of the overarching question here is, what do the diets of these four predator species, and especially these muskellunge, look like in Minnesota lakes? And then within that, we wanted to look at, are these species eating the same things? Because if there is a high level of overlap, that could lead to competition, which could have other effects down the line in terms of reproduction and growth and that kind of thing. The other big one that a lot of people always want to talk about is, are they eating each other? This is especially true for looking at if muskies are eating walleyes. Walleye is the state fish in Minnesota. A lot of people love to catch them and eat them. It's also, you know, you see videos online every once in a while of somebody reeling in an eater walleye, and then a muskie comes up from the depths and grabs it. And so that's a really striking image for a lot of people, and it makes you wonder if maybe that's what's going on naturally as well. And then we also wanted to look at both lakes with and without muskies, just to kind of see if there were maybe some indirect effects of muskies on these other fish populations.
Very, very cool. Now, I how would you have, you caught many, many fish, and looking at the diets, how did you do that? Electrofishing, netting?
Yeah, a little bit of a combination of both, or all the above, I guess. Electrofishing was definitely the most effective and was honestly our preferred method if we could get away with it. It lets us sample the most amount of fish the most efficiently. The fish stay alive, which is a key aspect, especially when you're looking at muskies, just because they do occur at such low population densities, and they're stocked, so they're pretty valuable in these lakes where they're occurring. We did use trap nets in the spring during the spawning. If the DNR was out doing a population survey at the same time, we would use fish caught in trap nets. We tried to avoid it if we could, though, just because you kind of introduce some potential biases there in terms of either fish feeding on other fish that are captured in the nets, or fish getting stressed out in the nets and actually regurgitating things they've eaten already, and then that can kind of skew our results one way or the other.
Yeah, that's cool.
We did use some gill nets as well, predominantly in the summer when especially the walleye and pike tended to hang out in a little bit deeper water. Our electrofishing gear just wasn't really designed to sample fish in deeper water. That said, we did catch very few muskies caught in the gill net, and that's pretty typical, even in kind of the standard population estimates and population surveys that Minnesota DNR does every summer. It's very rare to catch more than maybe an odd muskie here and there in a gill net. It just isn't the best gear for them. Then we actually tried angling for these fish a couple times too. Admittedly, this was pretty ineffective and inefficient. We only caught a handful of fish, and even the ones that we did catch, their stomachs were empty, so they didn't really provide us with much useful data.
Hmm. So just for the listeners who don't understand, would you mind explaining electrofishing and what that process looks like?
Yeah, definitely. So essentially you have kind of this big flat bottom boat with kind of chandelier looking things that hang off the front of the boat. It's just wires that hang off of big dropper arms down into the water. And then that whole system is hooked up to a generator that sits on the back of the boat. And so this generator kicks out electrical current, just like if it's hooked up to your permanent fish house out on the lake in the winter. And then it basically sends that current out through the dropper arms into the water, and then the boat hull actually acts as the cathode in that system. So it's just creating a continuous electrical current between those dropper arms and the boat hull. And then any fish that's kind of within a pretty tight radius, it's about 6 to 10 feet around the dropper arms, depending on the conductivity of the water and how you have the whole system set up. And it basically just forces the muscles of the fish to contract simultaneously. And so it immobilizes the fish. They typically will roll up on their bellies, and then they'll either kind of float up to the surface if everything is working the way you hope it does, or they'll end up actually kind of nose diving straight to the bottom, which is not ideal for our purposes. But you get really good at identifying the fish really quickly, so you know which species to grab, and you got to be really quick on your feet to grab those fish. And then it's kind of temperature dependent too. So in the spring and the fall, when the water's cold, The fish tend to be a little bit more lethargic, so you can actually get the boat closer to the fish before you actually turn the system on, and then that'll kind of induce that response immediately, and you have a little bit better chance of netting the fish. In the summer, those fish are typically up and moving around quite a bit more, and they're just because their metabolism is so much higher, they're able to kind of feel that electrical current from a farther distance and get away. We actually had a couple of different times where a muskie jumped straight up out of the water in front of the boat, almost like Shamu at SeaWorld. And then as soon as it hit the water, it had been out of the water, out of the current just enough that it kind of regained its bearings, and it hits the water and takes off, and you can kind of see the wake of the fish 40 feet out towards deeper water, and then you just kind of shake your head and go look for the next one.
Yeah, that's cool. So just to go back, you said you tried angling for them. We can touch on this later, but based on where you're locating muskies may depend on if they're feeding heavily, metabolizing. Just out of curiosity, I mean, you were the one that did some of these studies, so I expect you to know this better than anyone, but in those shallower, were you targeting shallower fish? Because I know you said that there wasn't anything in their stomach. Do you think that was just coincidence, or were they in areas where they were metabolizing, not feeding?
Actually, I would almost look at it the other way, where they were fish that were feeding, just because, especially in cooler water, but even in warmer water, it takes quite a bit of time for them to digest their food, especially when they're swallowing everything whole. You're just relying on those stomach enzymes to really break everything down. And all the angling that we did was predominantly in the summer when the water temperatures were warm. So they should be feeding a little bit more frequently at that time anyways. We did primarily target shallower water, but maybe a little bit more on the edge of shallow water as opposed to up on big flats or weed beds like we would with electrofishing. So kind of targeting similar areas. Part of it too was just we were kind of getting stuck in terms of, well, we're not getting fish electrofishing, we're not getting fish in nets, we're kind of running out of options here, and we need to try something to try to get some fish that we can look at. So that was kind of our last resort in those instances.
Yeah. And Camden, my understanding, and this is again super, super fascinating, is that once you had the fish, whether it was, I assume primarily muskies that you use this technique, and it's called gastric lavage. And I guess the way I kind of rationalize it, it's, you know, if a young baby or a young child swallowed a bottle of aspirins and you rush to emergency and they would flush your stomach out, that's what you did to the fish to find out what they're eating.
It is, and we actually did this process on all four species. We were able to kind of use some fish that either died in gill nets, or especially in 2020 when we were dealing with kind of COVID regulations in terms of what we could and couldn't do. We weren't able to handle any muskies, but we were able to go out and collect fish and then bring them back to a lab and process them kind of, you know, socially distant from each other. So in those cases, we did kind of just remove the stomachs from dead fish and look at them that way. But for all the muskies and a very high proportion of the other three species as well, that's exactly what we were doing, using lake water and kind of bilge pumps and hose materials that you can get at a local hardware store to just flush out anything that is in the fish's stomach. We had kind of a copper tube on the inside of a piece of hose that let us put the pipe towards the back of the fish's stomach. And then as you pump water in there, it just fills up and creates back pressure. And with the pipe being farther back in the stomach, it gets behind anything they've eaten recently and just forces it back out the same way it went in. Smaller stuff came out really easily. You kind of had to watch out because it could come out pretty quick and with some force, so you didn't want to be too close to the business end if that was the case. But then there was other stuff too. I know, like, if you've ever looked down the throat of a fish, you can kind of just see where the throat kind of expands and contracts, and it's pretty tight generally. And so if they had eaten, say, like a large sucker or something bigger, even if there weren't necessarily spines or anything that would get caught, just the size, it was difficult to get it to come back out through that opening. So we had to do a little convincing on some of those. We actually found that kitchen tongs that you could get at a local Target or Walmart or some kind of store helped out there, especially with the muskies. They're long enough that you can kind of stick them back into their throat without putting your fingers in danger.
And I'm assuming if you have a large fish, you've now got a lot of food out of their stomachs to try and identify. And you did such precise work. My understanding is you measured down to the nearest millimeter. And you even use DNA analysis. So I guess that means, Camden, you can fill me in here, but if there was a backbone of a fish and you're trying to determine if that's a sucker or a cisco or a walleye, you actually use DNA analysis to identify what the various food items were.
Yeah, we did that a little bit, and thankfully that wasn't anything that I had to do directly. Those samples actually ended up being the easiest for me in a lot of cases because I looked at it, realized that it wasn't anything that I would be able to identify on my own, and then I just repackaged the sample, and we were able to send it off to a lab. One of the colleagues through Minnesota DNR has done a lot of genetics work in the past. And so we were able to send it down to his lab, and he was able to process those samples and kind of let us know what those samples were. But in terms of other things, yeah, it was a process. I'm very thankful I had several awesome interns throughout the whole project that really helped out on both the field and the lab aspects of the project. And we got really good at identifying different kinds of fish lots of different ways, from kind of traditional things that anglers use, like color patterns or external body features, all the way down to looking at just different bones that the fish have that have different shapes depending on what species they are. So we found that like clythra and otoliths were really good at that. And those structures are really nice too because they are bony, so it takes a long time for those to digest. And then, yeah, trying to estimate the size of the prey that was eaten too, so that we can look at relationships between predator and prey size and that kind of thing. So we measured whole fish to the nearest millimeter, and then we actually went so far as to kind of develop equations to estimate total length of fish based on, you know, backbone lengths or clythrum or otolith lengths. So it was definitely a process. So
we're proud to have Williams Lures as one of our podcast partners. Whether you're fishing for brookies, bass, or walleyes, lake trout, northern pike, or muskies, you can always find a Williams spoon for the occasion. They're precision crafted in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and every one is a testament to quality. For over a century, Williams has adorned their spoons with jewelry-grade silver and 24-karat gold. That not only ensures longevity, but provides unparalleled flash that captivates even the wariest fish. When you're planning your next fishing trip, be sure to put Williams spoons into your tackle box.
So during that process, would you use the species, the size potentially, to determine where these fish are traveling? Because I know there's certain, like, say for example, in midsummer months in larger basins, if the muskies are eating ciscos, it likely means they're going out over deep water and targeting roughly the thermocline. Do you use their diet to determine how far they travel? Because you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is your work where it's found that actually 50% of muskies never reach shore. Was that you that did that spend the majority of their life? Okay, because that was Gordo, what was that study?
Was Jordan Weeks in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And it was interesting that you know, they, I guess the bigger in Camden, you can talk to this, the muskies seem to almost be individuals, say. They have very specific characteristics. And I always remember Dr. John Castleman is a great friend, and John did work on lake trout. And what fascinated John was when he did diet studies on lake trout is when they locked on a food item, they almost specifically locked onto it. And he said you would find one lake trout that was eating nothing but snails and another one eating nothing but ciscos. Did you find similar things with muskies, Camden?
No. Muskies were the oddballs in that sense. So, yeah, their diets were kind of all over the place. They would have... There's one that sticks out in my mind that's kind of the poster child of this. So there was one muskie that had 101 different individual prey fish in its stomach at the time that we captured it. And it was mostly yellow perch. 97 of them were yellow perch. But then there were also parts of two bullheads, a sucker, and a sunfish in the stomach as well. And that's kind of the extreme example, but there were definitely cases where, you know, you'd pull out, say, a pike and a cisco, or a bullhead and some invertebrates, or just kind of weird combinations of things from the musky stomachs, whereas the other three species definitely tended to specialize a little bit more on what they were eating.
Can we back up maybe a sec, Liam? And Camden said something that I thought was really, really intriguing when he talked about looking at the items, the size, the shape, color. Before we really get into the specifics, I'm curious, Camden, what were each of the fish primarily eating? And I guess more specifically, what are the key diet items of muskies?
Yeah, so for muskies, perch were the most important, but they only accounted for about a quarter of the diet. Suckers and invertebrates each accounted for about 10%. And then bullheads, northern pike, bass, and sunfish all made up about 5% of the diet. So really just kind of broad diet patterns, different shapes, different sizes, different habitats where you'd find lots of those fish. So they were just kind of all over the place. And like I said, they were kind of the oddballs in terms of how generalized their diet was. Pike and walleye had the most similar diets of any two species pairs of the four that we looked at, and they ate primarily perch, sunfish, and crappies. The exact proportions of those three groups were different depending on the lake. There was a bit of a trade-off between, say, eating more perch in some systems and then more sunfish or panfish in the other systems. But kind of across the board, those three groups made up over 80% of the diet for both of those species. So they were really keyed in on those prey items.
Wow. And well, then, I mean, you know, oh, sorry, Cam. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you'll notice, walleye didn't make up any of that. So that's pretty fascinating. I mean, you touched on it in the beginning. People see, oh, a muskie hit my walleye while I was, you know, battling it. This happens all the time. People are always like, oh, they're eating walleyes because they'll come up and smack it. Your studies show this. Number of other studies show that they're not targeting walleyes. And in fact, it's likely just the fact that you're hooked to a flailing fish causing commotion in the middle of the water column that attracts a forager like a muskie's attention. But it is fascinating. But it sounds silly almost to say, like, they don't like walleye. I'd imagine there's another reason for that, but I have no idea what it is. Like, do you know why they don't target walleyes? Is it a locational thing? Is it a fact that they're so armored?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say it's anything to do with location, just because there were lots of times where when we're electrofishing, especially on a lot of the lakes in Minnesota, we've got really clear water. So you can see kind of everything that's going around down there. And there'd be lots of times where, you know, we go through and we hit a pod of walleyes and we scoop a bunch up that we're going to look at their stomachs. And then not 10 yards down the weed bed or the brake line, there's a big muskie hanging out and we get that one too. So they are definitely using a lot of the same habitats. In terms of why we're not seeing more walleye in the stomachs, it could be that muskies are actively avoiding muskies. Like you said, they've got lots of sharp spines, and even like their scales and their gills can be pretty sharp and rough. Just even when you're handling them and when you're out fishing, I know I've gotten poked and scratched multiple times. So I can't imagine that's a very pleasant experience for a muskie if it's trying to swallow it whole. But it's also possible that walleye are just better at avoiding being eaten than some of the other species. Walleye are predators just like muskies. They're built a little bit differently, but in both cases, they're kind of built for some really quick bursts of speed that help them capture their prey. And so that might be just enough to help them get away from muskies almost as much as it is helping them capture their own prey.
Camden, it's really interesting listening to you because Liam and I, we live on Lake of the Woods, and we've been out many, many times, and it's exactly what you said, and this has shocked me so many times. We'll be catching walleyes, and we might catch 6, 7, 8 walleyes, and then all of a sudden the activity kind of slows down or stops, and yet we're seeing all kinds of fish on our screen. And many times I've dropped the AquaView camera down, and what has shocked me is they were white suckers. And the white suckers, I'm assuming because white sucker and walleye share many, many characteristics, similar water temperature preferences, etc., etc. But they're swimming together as our perch. And so as Liam says, if you're a muskie, and you're coming onto this spot, it's almost like you say, I don't care that there's walleyes here, and you go after the white sucker or the perch.
Right, and kind of back to Liam's point, like I've had conversations with people before. If you look at, say, a white sucker that's rigged up on a quick strike rig under a bobber in the fall, that really doesn't look that much different than a walleye that's got a jig through its top lip and somebody's reeling it back in. Especially, you know, in Minnesota, it's not uncommon for muskie anglers to use suckers that are 14 to 18 inches long, which is, you know, kind of a perfect eater-sized walleye for a lot of people. So if you've got that kind of swimming around and struggling to try to get away because it's not comfortable being restricted like that, it really doesn't look the same. I haven't done any studies in terms of what muskie's vision is like, but I can't imagine they're able to pick up on some of the subtle differences in the coloration and the patterns between a walleye and a sucker. So I think, yeah, like Liam had said, it just looks like something that's struggling, is vulnerable. It's up in the kind of the middle of the water column. It's not swimming very fast. It's not moving properly. It just looks like a really easy meal for an opportunistic predator.
Right. So they are an opportunity. I mean, based on the diet studies that you've done, they clearly are an opportunistic predator. That's a great way to put it. They're essentially just foraging. Like, they're eating whatever they can find and obviously avoiding the stuff they either can't catch or don't like walleyes. But that is really neat because, like you were saying about lake trout, is they do dial in on specific prey, where muskies are kind of like eating whatever they have access to. Is that right?
Yeah, yep, it certainly seems that way. And that's not to say that the other species aren't doing something kind of similar, like I mentioned with the pike and the walleye. There was a little bit of a trade-off between perch and panfish, depending on the system. So I really think, you know, more or less it comes down to what's available in the specific water body. But muskies, just because of their size, because of how they're built, they're able to kind of exploit a broader range of the species that are present in the system. And it's super oddball things too. We found a few bowfin and musky diets, birds, muskrats, frogs, kind of anything that's available. Especially you think about some of those largest adult muskies. There's very few things other than other adult muskies in most of these lakes that they would have any real issue trying to grab onto and swallow. So they're basically, the whole lake ecosystem is their food web at that point.
You touched on a really, really good point there, because I recall reading in the journal Camden, that you wrote that memorable size muskies, and these are the fish many of the folks I'm sure listening in, that's what they hope to catch. You said memorable size muskies prefer or eat different prey items than do smaller muskies. What would those differences be?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense when you look at it one way, and then it gets really confusing once you look at it the other way. So generally speaking, we saw that smaller muskies, and I think the cutoff for memorable size was something like 44 inches. So anything that size and smaller, they tended to consume more perch, bass, and sunfish, which kind of makes sense. Those tend to be on the smaller end, especially in a lot of the systems we were in. Bigger fish tended to consume more suckers, and that pattern makes sense as well. You know, the big, fleshy bait fish like that, you need a little bit bigger mouth, a little bit bigger gape size to be able to swallow those fish. Where it gets goofy is we also saw that that larger muskie were more likely to consume invertebrates than some of the smaller fish. And I've talked to a lot of different people about this, and I don't have a good reason or explanation why that might be the case. We did tend to see more invertebrates in the diets in the summer than we did in the spring and the fall. It's possible that maybe we're sampling more of the smaller fish in the spring and the fall and more of the bigger fish in the summer, and that's driving it. Other than that, I can't think of any good reason why a 44 to 50 plus inch muskie would be trying to consume mayfly larvae or flies or midges or any of the other things we saw.
I was just going to mention that because we just did a podcast on mayflies, and they hatch in the summer months. They're June, July flies is what they should be called. Gordo always jokes, but that's crazy to think that a fish that size is also, I guess, taking advantage of the mayfly hatch.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people, they talk about the mayfly hatch and, oh, walleye fishing gets really tough because there's mayflies all over the place. Those walleyes are keying in on them. If you get lucky enough to catch a few, their stomachs are just packed full with mayflies. It makes sense. There's this really abundant prey source that's relatively easy to capture and has pretty good energy content given the amount of work that goes into getting them. We didn't see anything like that in muskies. We would catch a big muskie that literally had one mayfly nymph in its stomach. So I don't know if it's just they're swallowing water as they're swimming around and just happen to get a couple bugs here and there. If they are actually able to use their lateral lines to key in on those small bugs that are moving around, and they're just not as good at kind of going through the buffet line like some of the other fish are and getting big masses of them at the same time. It's really confusing, and yeah, just kind of one of those things that I've chalked up to, well, muskies are weird and we don't have a good explanation for it.
Camden, when I read it, I was interested because I think it was 2 years ago, Buddy and I were out crappie fishing. And I had on, a 1/16 ounce jig and a minnow that was smaller than your smallest finger. And he caught the biggest muskie of the year on it. And I think often, not unlike the invertebrates, if it's in front of them and it's moving and it's easy prey, that you just open your mouth and eat it. It's not going to swim across the shoal to eat a crappie jig, and it's probably not going to swim 100 yards to pick up a mayfly larva. But if it's slowly cruising across the bottom, and when we did the podcast with Bev Ritchie on mayflies, there's often 120 larvae per square meter on the, like, that's picking up chocolate-covered almonds. So, I mean, why not?
Right. Yeah, I think I've heard someone else kind of equate it to, you know, if you're say at a holiday party or something, and there's cheeseburgers out on a platter, and then at the end of the line there's a bowl full of M&Ms or chocolate covered almonds or whatever. you don't have to be hungry to reach your hand in and grab a couple of those M&Ms or a couple of almonds every time you walk past the table. Just because it's there, it's available, you look at it and you say, yeah, why not? So, yeah, I think there's definitely something to that in terms of the muskies as well. They're big fish, and it takes a lot of energy and a lot of prey mass to kind of sustain their growth rates, especially in kind of those early to middle size ranges. And then even as they get bigger, to be able to sustain the reproductive burden or the energetic burden of producing eggs, producing milt, reproducing, and then the little bit of growth on top of that. If there's a really easy meal that's around, it's really hard to justify them passing that up.
I was really, Dr. John Catt, John's a dear, dear friend. We worked together for many, many years at OM&R here in Ontario. And the late Dr. Ed Crossman, one of the classic muskie research projects was the Clythrum project. And John and Ed did that. It was spread over about 20 some odd years. And when they did the analysis there, Camden, on food items, and they actually tracked down taxidermists right around North America, and they had them examine the stomachs of the fish that they were mounting for various folks who had caught muskies. And one of the key items they found, and it, again, always fascinated me, was brown bullheads. And I always remember going out with the biologists here on the lake and on our assessment unit in the spring, and in our trap nets that we had set for walleyes, there sometimes would be 1,000 to 2,000 bullheads in the trap net. And not surprisingly, I think, you saw much the same thing.
Yeah, we did. It wasn't so much, you know, that there were hundreds of bullheads that we saw in the diets, but the ones that we did see tended to be, you know, fairly good size, anywhere from, like, say, 9 to 13 inch bullheads, which, especially with bullheads, they grow as big around as much as they do long a lot of times, so that's a pretty good meal for a muskie. This is one I've thought about too, because like we were talking about earlier with the walleye, I can't imagine trying to swallow a bullhead is a very pleasant experience for a fish just because of the spines. Right. So part of me thinks that it just has something to do with the way that bullheads move through the water. They're not exactly the fastest swimmers. It takes quite a bit of tail kick for them to get moving. So I think that it's probably just, yeah, another one of those things where it looks like a pretty easy meal. It's not going anywhere very fast. And there's definitely energetic benefits for those fish to grab those. So, and especially in certain systems, like you mentioned, bullheads can be very prolific and very abundant at certain times. So if that's an available food source for those predators, there's no reason why they wouldn't grab them.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, and the other thing, too, is they're in very similar areas, and they're very abundant. So if they are just an opportunistic feeder, it does make sense. But I can imagine they wouldn't be the most pleasant to swallow.
Except
that, right?
They don't have scales. They're a soft fish and no scales. And really, for sure, they have spines. But if you swallow them head first, everything just gets collapsed, and so, yeah, one man meets another man's poison.
And they're kind of the perfect shape to kind of just slide straight down into the stomach, too. There may be, a little bit of a battle once you grab it, and you've got to get those spines positioned in a way that you can get them going down, but then once you get, like you said, when you get those spines folded in, it's probably not too bad.
Maybe, and you raised another really, really good point that I wanted to talk a little bit about. One of the things that shocked me, now I know you divided the muskie into lakes with ciscos, without ciscos, and you divided it into four different lake types, I believe. But in one of the lake types, the number one prey item, if I'm not mistaken, was northern pike. And again, anglers never use the term fusiform, But when you think about, and I've always talked about this, Camden, and I think it's a huge mistake amongst musky lure makers. When we talk bigger, we always tend to go wide. And in fact, the key with fusiform species is longer. And so instead, every time we go from, say, an 8-inch bait to a 16-inch bait, we always tend to increase the, we really should keep it not too wide, but long. And that, and to me, that just makes so much sense as to why they're eating northern pike. Long, lean, again, not really scaly, no sharp fins. But I was shocked that muskies in some of your lakes, the number one prey item was northern pike.
Yeah, kind of. I've had some similar conversations with people, and they're confused about that as well. And I kind of tell them, you know, if you think about, you know, say a 20-inch pike is kind of average for the sizes that we saw, maybe a little bit on the high end. But if you look at that, it's just a giant foot-long hot dog with fins that's swimming around in the water. There's nothing to stop it from just sliding straight down into your stomach once you get it turned around. So yeah, it's one of those things that's really easy to swallow. And a lot of our lakes too, we have just really abundant small size structure pike populations kind of throughout the state in a lot of different systems. So, I mean, in a lot of those cases, those pike can be one of the most abundant other fish species in the lake. And so that just makes it all that more probable that a muskie is going to swim by and grab one as opposed to some of the other things that we saw in the stomachs.
Yeah, I mean, the only armor on a pike is in its mouth. Other than that, it literally, like you said, is just a foot-long hot dog.
I got to remember that one. That's a good way of describing it. We'll come back because one of your goals, Camden, was to determine if there was overlap with amongst the species and whether they compete for the same food and whether they eat each other. And so what did you discover as kind of the baseline results?
Have you ever wondered what it takes for soft plastic baits to truly uphold the Rapala legacy? As an angler since childhood, Rapala has been a part of the entire journey. I want to welcome you to Crush City, a destination in the mind of every angler where the fish are big and the bite is hot. After meticulous testing, I can confidently say that the Crush City soft plastics live up to the legacy. With superior shapes, action, and scent, these baits have become the go-to for myself and other avid multi-species anglers, ultimately putting more fish in the boat or on the ice. The smart injection technology combines custom combinations of color, flake, salt, and scent that are added precisely where needed for the perfect presentation. Experience the difference for yourself. You can try the family-priced Crush City soft plastics and discover Crush City.
Yeah, so kind of the big picture results, like I mentioned earlier, walleye and pike diets were very similar, kind of regardless of the lake type we looked at. That's not necessarily to say that they're competing for food. I think one of the distinctions between how, as a scientist and as anglers, we think about competition, as anglers, you tend to think of, well, if they're eating the same thing, they must be competing for it. As scientists, we're kind of taught you can share resources as long as those resources aren't limiting. So the only time that we really move from sharing resources into competition is if those prey fish become so limiting that there is kind of some downstream effects of the sharing that's going on. And because of the kinds of fish that the walleye and the pike were eating, you know, those abundant perch and small sunfish, we don't really think that that's a competition issue, at least not yet, but it's definitely something to keep in mind going forward. There's been some other research in Minnesota that's looked at kind of changes in the perch populations through time, and they're seeing not so much a change in abundance, but definitely a change in size structure, where a lot of the perch populations are getting smaller through time. And so that could be, you know, maybe an okay thing for some of these predators, because that just means that those fish aren't getting as big. They're not outgrowing kind of the opportunity to be eaten by these predators. But if we continue to see different changes in those perch populations, that could be something that would be an issue down the road. In terms of muskies, though, their diets were vastly different from all the other species, with kind of one exception, and it was a much smaller similarity than pike and walleye, but muskies and walleye tended to share some of the same prey resources in the spring. And that's when we saw muskies really key in on some of the perch. And it seemed like it was especially prevalent when perch were up spawning, kind of just shortly after ice out. Perch will spawn even before the muskies will. So I kind of thought of it as kind of that last feeding binge for the muskies, while the perch are focused on making more perch instead of focused on not being eaten. And the walleyes are doing a lot of the same things too. The walleyes will spawn shortly after the perch will. And so that's where we did tend to see a little bit more overlap between the muskies and the walleyes. But again, those perch populations in a lot of the lakes we looked at are just so abundant that it's not really a competition issue, at least not yet.
Right. That's interesting. So I can't remember, do perch spawn just before or just after walleyes?
So in terms of the kind of the primary fish in our area, pike go first. They're almost, well, burbot go first if you want to look at it that way, under the ice. But then pike will go either right before the ice comes off or right after. Usually it's kind of right as the ice is coming off is pike. Perch will go just shortly after that. And then after the perch, it's kind of the walleyes and the suckers will start to go. And then the muskies will go just a little bit after them, and then you'll get into the crappies and then the sunfish and the bass later in the summer.
Okay, so walleyes and muskies are feeding on perch before they spawn. It's not a post-spawn thing.
Right, it seems that way. And that was kind of one of the, we didn't do any analyses on it, but one of the interesting anecdotes, this was especially true for for walleyes and muskies. You would get a pretty good sample of diets right away early in the spring, as soon as we could get out onto the lakes. But once those fish started to really congregate and start their spawning activities, you could catch a lot of fish, but none of them were eating at that time, which was super interesting. It's just like somebody flipped a light switch. They went from feed mode right as soon as the ice went off to I'm not even thinking about food right now. And it was very obvious, to the point where we would be out on lakes catching lots of fish and we would go home early because it just wasn't worth our time to keep catching and processing fish because none of them were eating. So that was one of the really interesting kind of anecdotes that I took away from this, is just kind of that light switch from feed mode to spawn mode, and then it was a much more gradual change back into feeding mode on the back end.
Really? And that's as they start to move out from their spawning areas?
It can be in some of the same areas, too. It's not so much the movement, but it definitely seemed like we tended to see more males as we got later into the spawning period, which makes sense. They're usually the first ones there, and then they linger the longest. And they still could be in kind of that spawn mode where they're not really thinking about food, whereas the females have moved on. But eventually, as we went later into the spring, you did start seeing more and more fish that were eating, but it was a much more gradual change than it was on the front end.
Cool. Camden, I got to ask you one more question about ciscos, because I know you discovered in both the gastric lavage and when you did the analysis, not very many ciscos showed up. Whereas in other studies, in other lakes, ciscos have comprised up to 50% of the diet, I believe. And I know you did caution in your write-up that it possibly part of the reason was sampling techniques. If you sample in shallow water, you might have been. But that kind of implies then that those shallow fish aren't moving out into deeper waters to feed on whitefish and ciscos, that they tend to stay shallow for most of the year then, correct?
Yeah, it's not quite that simple. So after we submitted that first paper, we actually sampled a couple additional lakes as that paper was in the review process. And those two lakes, we actually saw that Cisco made up quite a bit higher proportion of the musky diets. So it seems like there's a little bit of kind of lake morphology that might play into it as well. Both of those lakes that we sampled on the tail end tended to have kind of long, shallow flats right close to shoreline, and then very steep drop-offs into deep water directly off those flats. So you would drop from kind of like a 6-foot bulrush bed out into the basin in, you know, a cast length, essentially. And those are the kinds of lakes where we tended to see higher Cisco consumption. So it seems like there's something playing into kind of how the lake is physically that allows those fish to move back and forth between the two different habitats. The other thing that kind of plays into it, after looking at some of the data that we have, a couple of the lakes that were considered Cisco lakes in the original study probably don't have the greatest Cisco populations at this point. This diet study that we did using gastric lavage was in conjunction with another study using stable isotopes, which is basically just chemical ratios from tissue samples to see what fish are eating kind of over a longer time scale. And in order to do that, you have to get tissue samples from not just the predators, but also all the way down the food chain so that you can kind of build that into your models. And in a couple of those lakes where we called them Cisco lakes, because there's supposed to be Ciscos and there are some Ciscos in those lakes, it took them, you know, 3-4 tries with very specialized netting equipment designed specifically for sampling Ciscos in deeper water just to get, you know, 15 to 30 Ciscos that they could get tissue samples from. So it's probably pretty likely that those Cisco populations just aren't abundant enough to make up a huge proportion of the diets, especially for those shallower muskies that we were talking with targeting with our sampling.
So the whole expenditure of energy principle, it's just not worth my while to go out as an ambush predator looking for very, very scattered Ciscos that are probably better equipped to avoid getting eaten by me.
Right. And there's, you know, I've talked to some anglers and I've heard other people discuss kind of this concept of subpopulations within lakes where there's a certain segment of the musky population that the only time they're in shallow water is to spawn, and then they're suspended over deep water the rest of the year. And then there's other fish that will move up on shallow structure early in the year, and they'll either stay there all summer or they'll kind of move back and forth between the habitat types throughout the year. I don't know enough, and we don't kind of have good data on whether that's the case in these systems, but it certainly seems like a possibility, especially talking to anglers who say, well, yeah, I know you were on this lake and you didn't see Cisco in the diets, but I only fish open water and I catch lots of fish out there doing it. So it certainly seems like that's a possibility as well. How you would go around actually looking at that scientifically and trying to quantify that, I have no idea, but certainly seems like a possibility in some lakes.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, it does make total sense too. I mean, they're an ambush predator, and Ciscos have, they're equipped to escape lake trout, which are one of the fastest fish in the lake. And you know, out in open water, muskies likely, just from a mechanical disadvantage, don't necessarily have what it takes to maybe, I don't know exactly, but they don't appear to me, at least in my mind and from some of the stuff that I've read, to be, you know, as fast or as agile as lake trout. So it probably does pose a little bit more of a challenge.
But if you're in a lake like maybe Lake of the Woods, where the Ciscos are up there amongst the most plentiful fish in the lake, then all of a sudden, you're right, you may be at a disadvantage being an ambush predator, but there's so many ciscos that, you know, it still might be worth your while. And when we talked to Chris Therrien, the cisco specialist, there is nothing, Chris was saying, from a nutritional perspective that is better than, he said they are the profound food fish for virtually everything that swims. So if there, and Camden, you kind of did say the same thing, if there's so many of them out there, then that's the case where they probably would. But if there's only one or two floating around, stay shallow and eat mayfly larvae.
Right. Yeah. And it could be one of those things too, where even in lakes where the ciscos aren't super abundant, they do still tend to be schooling fish. So it's very possible that, you know, there's a pod of muskies that kind of follow those schools of ciscos around throughout the year. But in terms of just the total proportion of the population that's able to use that resource, it's a lot smaller in those lakes with fewer cisco, and that just makes it that much harder for us to capture one individual fish that had happened to eat a cisco within the last, you know, couple days at the longest, depending on how long it takes to digest those fish.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Well, and the other thing too, in that study that we were talking about earlier, where it shows that up to or roughly 50% of muskies, other than spawning, never touch shore. They're suspended out in open water. Now, I don't know if your studies have shown similar things, but I can't imagine those fish are easy to catch when they're suspended out in the middle of the lake. Like electrofishing, netting, angling is very, very difficult. So are those, do we, as an industry, not know a lot about those fish based on how hard they are to access?
Yeah, I would say in all likelihood, anglers probably know more about those suspended fish than scientists do at this point, just because they're interacting with them so much more. You know, it seems like anymore it's really hard to find a video on YouTube or an article talking about fishing shallow structure for muskies. The kind of focus right now is on those suspended fish that are eating those oily bait fish. And for good reason. It definitely seems like those folks are contacting bigger fish constantly. It seems like one of those things where they probably have a better handle on what those fish are doing, how they're acting, what they're feeding on than we do. We did see some fish kind of out open water as we were moving from spot to spot with the electrofishing boat. But, you know, unless you hit those fish just right and they float straight to the surface, there's no chance you're going to get them, because they're going to sink down beyond what you can reach with your net right away. And just the prospect of driving around a 2,000 acre lake to a 15,000 acre lake just out in the middle of the basin looking for a random muskie that's within the top couple feet of the water column. We could do that for years and maybe only catch a couple fish. So we definitely need to figure out a better way to sample those fish if we want to learn exactly what they're doing.
I wonder if live imaging is going to play a part on that. You can get larger transducers that shoot out 175 feet with clarity. I wonder if the DNR will ever take that into account when doing some of these studies.
We talked about it a little bit. So this project all happened while I was a grad student and then a research assistant at Bemidji State University. And the college has one of the older panoptics units that they've used for a couple different projects through the years. And we discussed, you know, trying to rig it up on the electrofishing boat and seeing if we could get some fish, maybe not even necessarily out over the deep basin, but, you know, if we were driving along a brake line or a weed bed, just having it pointed at an angle out towards deeper water, and if there's a fish just hanging off the edge there, then we could go and try to look for it that way. But yeah, like I said, as soon as you get deeper than your net pole is long, it's maybe a 50-50 shot if you even have a chance to get that fish, even if you're able to find the fish and get on top of it with the boat and shock them. There's just so many other variables that go into actually getting that fish on board that it's really hard to justify the time, energy, that goes into doing that when we could get decent sample sizes up shallow, even if it wasn't necessarily sampling the whole population.
Now I'm going to put Camden on the spot. What a lot of folks don't realize is you're an accomplished angler as well as a muskie scientist. So spill the beans. Now that you have this massive scientific database in your mind, and you know things that the rest of us don't know from a science perspective, how does that affect your planning to go fishing? What do you do different than Liam and I? And how does your how do you incorporate that into your strategies?
Well, first, that's very generous of you to consider me an accomplished angler. I definitely view myself as much more of a beginner musky angler. I do fish quite a bit, and I'm definitely a multi-species angler. Muskies are my preference when I have the chance, but in terms of actual success musky fishing, that's still been fairly limited up to this point. That said, using what I learned through this project to try to inform my angling decisions, I guess the first thing I would say is that it's not always worth the shoulder ache to throw the big baits all the time. We did see that bigger fish were more likely to eat big prey fish, but there were still lots of really large muskies that were eating, you know, 3-inch perch, 5-inch sunfish, just really small prey fish that are much more similar to some of the reasonable sized musky lures that don't hurt your arms and your backs and your wrists the whole day when you're out throwing lures. So I tend to use that to justify maybe throwing some of the smaller baits than some of the larger baits. Kind of the bigger thing, though, is that there were a lot of times when we were sampling multiple fish in a relatively small area. And I think that's kind of a concept that more and more anglers are catching on to recently from some of the conversations I've had. But in the past, it seemed like a lot of people referred to muskies as kind of this solitary predator where, you know, you fish a structure. If you catch a fish, great. Pull the trolling motor, start the big motor up, go to your next spot because you caught the one fish that's on that structure and the fish are active. So now you just need to keep moving spot to spot as soon as you catch a fish. What we saw is that good spots are really good spots, and there can be multiple fish on a good spot. So I've kind of translated that into my angling, where if I'm contacting fish, it's going to make me much more likely to kind of stick in a similar area, or at the very least look for other very similar type structures, rather than bouncing around from sand flats to weeds to rocks to points to cup bays, just different structures all the time. I'm going to tend to stick around in areas where I've been seeing fish and kind of just wait out an active fish or a feeding window as opposed to looking for other fish in different areas.
Okay. So that is interesting too. And just quickly, muskies are known to be territorial. And I think that's where that logic to move, if there's a big fish that you just caught, it kind of owns that spot. And I'm not saying that I know that to be the truth by any means, so it'd be interesting to see your take on that, because that is fairly common knowledge, I'll say in quotations, not necessarily correct knowledge, but...
Right, and part of it too could be dependent on your exact goals and objectives. If you're on the water looking for the queen of the lake, that, you know, mid to upper 50-inch fish, a 40-50-pound fish, that fish, in all likelihood, behaves a little bit differently than kind of the average muskie in the lake. So it could be that it's super territorial, it chases smaller fish off the spot. It could also be that it's kind of an old, lazy fish. It's figured out how to get the most out of life by doing the least amount of work, and it's just not going to go through the work of competing with some smaller, younger, faster fish on a spot, and it's just going to go somewhere else because it knows that it's big enough that it can get a meal anywhere in the lake. So it did seem like, you know, I talked about there were groups of fish on good structures. it was pretty rare that there was a true giant fish in those groups of fish. But even, you know, just good quality sized muskies, you know, low 40 inch fish all the way up to, you know, 47, 48 inch fish in some systems would be using similar structures. And part of it too is just the size of some of these structures. We've got some really big points and weed beds and break lines in a lot of the lakes that we looked at. So just because I say it's a good spot, that could be, you know, a quarter mile long weed bed that holds multiple fish as opposed to just the very tip of a point or an island or something where maybe there is only room for one or two fish.
I remember, this goes back a long, long time on Lake of the Woods here, probably 40 some odd years. We found a spot. It was the first time we'd ever fished it. And as we caught an over 30 pound fish, and the wind was drifting, so we drifted around the corner and we landed it, released it. And Camden, we came back to that very same spot, my partner and I, and we were both figure eighting over 48 inch fish together, front and back. So there were obviously three giants on that rock pile. Now, I'm not saying they're schooling, but it's probably such ideal habitat that, you know, you can have the front of the shoal, I'll have the back of the shoal, or you might have pulled off and I'll pull in. I think good spots are extremely good spots for many, many fish, and they could all have it as part of their summer home range. But that doesn't mean necessarily that they're schooling up like walleyes.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think that they're doing that, at least not in most systems. I will say I've heard reports from people that say kind of this, not so much schooling behavior, but multiple fish kind of stacking up on good spots seems to be more common in stocked fisheries than it is in natural fisheries. And that makes a little bit of sense too. If you think about the first year of life for those fish, they're packed on top of each other in tanks and small ponds and then stocking tanks all the way from the time they hatch to the time they get dumped into the lake. And then even when they get dumped into the lake, they're dumped in with, you know, a couple hundred of their siblings at the same time. So those fish might just be a little bit more accustomed to having other muskies around. But yeah, I don't think the muskies are schooling in the sense that, you know, walleye do or panfish or other fish. But yeah, if it's, you know, just a big enough spot that multiple fish can find a spot to sit and wait for something to swim by, or if there's good access to multiple different habitat types and fish are just constantly cycling through. But yeah, those good spots tend to hold fish constantly, and more often than not, it's more than one.